Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
So this week we're kind of celebrating the, 40th anniversary of Smokey and the Bandit?
It's been around forever, man.
So, yeah. We always try to find a cigar to go with our main topic. So what are we smoking this week, Brad?
So this week we've actually got the CAO, and this is part of the Flathead Still Horse series, but we're actually smoking the Roadkill.
If anybody's had the regular Flathead, and we've reviewed it here on the show, which is more of a hot rod themed, the Steel Horse was another blend they came out with that was more dedicated to motorcycle theme. So it's got nice... And like I said, I like the Roadkill because the label just has like a dead squirrel or something on it with like tire marks going across it.
Yes. But it's very cartoonish, so, as to not get anybody upset. So
yeah, and these all come in like, even though they're in like, regular cigar box, each individual cigar is in its own little cardboard box. So they're easier to transport when you're out on your bike or on the road. And kind of cool travel cigar.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I've picked these up in the past specifically knowing I'm going to events and stuff, so that way I just throw them in, a purse or whatever the case is, whoever's traveling with me, and you don't have to worry about stuff getting crushed or damaged.
Did you say you're going to throw it in your purse?
Not my purse. it's a satchel.
Yeah. It's a tactical man purse. There's a gun in it. It makes it tactical.
It's got Molly, it's man.
It's black. If it's black, that means it's tactical. Yeah, this has a Connecticut Habano Grueso wrapper and a Brazilian Arapicara wrapper. You almost have to say that, Beavis. Arapicara! Are you threatening me? And Dominican, Nicaraguan, and Honduran fillers.
Yeah, and the cigar comes in. It's a 5.5 by 54, and I'm gonna say this is probably medium foolish. Definitely the Habano comes through, so you're getting a little bit of the spicy notes, but it's not as powerful as some other Habano cigars that I smoke. So.
And it's a good, this, like I said, some of the, because, like I said, if you want to go all the way up, the A-Panger, I think it's the A-Panger, is like a 6.5 by 66. So that's, if you got 2 hours you need to kill, that's the way to go. But this one right here is a, being the 5.5 by 54, it's, still a nice hour smoke and stuff. But if you ain't got time for the full size, this is like good, I would say average size cigar.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that's one of the things that I like about the, Still Horse series is, I mean, you can get everything from, a 4.5 by 50 all the way up to the, bull neck, and you're getting into the 66 ring gauge, which, it's a 6.5 by 66. So that's
even in the regular flathead, you have the spark plug if you want to go with little tiny quick smoke. Yeah,
absolutely. And then, as gearheads, car enthusiasts, I mean, I thought that this was a really cool line that CAOA came out with. So I've been a big fan of just about everything I've had in the lineup.
Yeah, the other difference between these and the standard flatheads, I mean, they still have the flat tip, but original flatheads are all box press, and this is like your standard round cigar. So you don't have this trouble cutting it. Because the regular flathead, you need a punch or you need like a big, Zycar XO cutter is the only thing that'll fit those things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if your punch doesn't go up to a 70 ring gauge, even though it's a 60, those square, you know, ends, you know, I've definitely seen people, you know, do some very bad things to their cigars. So,
I mean, that's one of my favorite parts of getting this XO cutter was, like, it's big enough that I can cut a flathead without using a punch.
Something about the flathead series, I mean, it just works with a punch. I mean,
yeah, because that, you know, completely flat tip, it's hard to kind of judge where you need to cut it. Because, you know, on a regular brown tip cigar, you just kind of at the curve. But since this one's flat, you like you always feel like you're cutting
too much off.
You just
don't have much cap.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're pretty much, you know, pick you up a little punch, put it on your keychain. They're not that expensive. So, you know, if you ever want to hear out about them.
A lot of your torches even have the,
like I said, so I've got a couple lighters that have the built-in punch.
And, you know, if you're, and that's kind of leads me into another point. You know, I've got two or three lighters now that all have, you know, a little swing bar that's got a punch on the end of it. But, you know, one of the things is, you know, I look at the length of that swing bar, because if you start getting into a 60 gauge, like I've got one and the handle to strike the lighter is the on the same side as the swing bar for the punch, and it's hard to get a cigar centered and punched properly without damaging the wrapper.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I'd like to pick up one of those, the keychain punches. So it's like that, and it's always like, you know, because sometimes I'll just be out and about and stop at a cigar shop and not plan ahead, so I may not have my lighter and cutter on me. But if you got a little keychain cutter or keychain punch, you know, you're always prepared for action if need be.
Absolutely. So, you know, we'll continue with this cigar as we get into the main segment and everything else. But first, I think we need to talk about a little company called Strikeforce.
Yes. You know, if you're smuggling alcohol across the country, like, you know, we took a week off and we forgot how to do the freaking show. It's like, I can't take vacation anymore. I've still got vacation brain, which drinking Strikeforce will help with that. And, you know, so if you're going to, you know, make a smuggle booze across the country, like the Bandit. And
you're
like,
just hauling, you know. Yeah,
you make a 28-hour run and there's no time to sleep, call in the Strikeforce. StrikeforceEnergy.com. Use promo code Cigar Nerds for 20% off your order. And if you go to our Instagram account, there's a I posted a picture of my new drinking vessel. Because, yeah, I picked up while on vacation, my girlfriend bought me this badass skull pimp cup. And I'm like, there's nothing like drinking Strikeforce out of the skulls of your enemies. So I had to post that poster on our Instagram. But yeah, like I said, Strikeforce up, and we'll be right back.
Westbound and down, 18-wheeler rolling. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch old Bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal, son, never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got a run to make. The boys are thirsty in Atlanta, and there's beer in Texarkana, and we'll bring it back no matter what it takes. Westbound and down, 18 wheels are rolling. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch old Bandit run.
And welcome back to the podcast. It's time to get eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking.
Well, I mean, it depends on which direction you're going. I mean, there's a lot more west than there is east relative to our location.
Yep, this week we're talking about the Bandit.
He always gets the girl.
One of Burt Reynolds' most iconic roles, I think, of all the things Burt's done, he's probably mostly remembered as the Bandit and maybe the guy from Little Whorehouse in Texas. If you're a Dolly Parton fan.
I mean, I definitely attribute it, you know, to the Bandit. I mean, hell, I grew up not having cable or anything, and that seemed to be the most reran movie that TBS played back to back. But it was one that every time it was on, you couldn't help but watch it.
No, because it's like, I mean, made in 1977. starring Burt Reynolds, Sally Field, Jackie Gleason, Jerry Reed, Pat McCormick, Paul Williams, and Mike Henry. And also the directorial debut of stuntman Hal Needham, who you may have remembered when we were last week talking about our road trip movies. And one of the reasons why we didn't include Bandit is because we were planning the whole, giving him his whole movie. But Hal Needham's the one who also directed, you know, the Cannonball Run films.
Yes.
So, yeah. And that is
not probably to be confused with Cannonball.
Yeah. And that's also probably why the, you know, car action sequences and stuff were so over the top epic, because, you know, when you have a director who is a stunt man, of course he's going to fall back on what he knows best, which is stunt work. Kind of like when we talked about John Wick. I mean, that was a movie made by stuntmen and action choreographers, so there's a lot of action and gunplay in that, because, you know, you write what you know.
But, I mean, you know, I gotta say, with, you know, the, and I don't know, we might get into it a little bit, but primarily we're going to focus on the first three, you know, full-length movies. Only the first one was the one worth watching.
I mean, the second one had, like, originally when we come up with this and you're like, there's only one good Bandit movie, I'm like, I don't know, I thought the second one was watchable. And then I rewatched the second one, and it's got some good moments, but then there's some parts I'm like, this is just fucking ridiculous.
Yes.
And we'll get there when we start talking about that one. Oh.
But, you know, I mean, as iconic as the Bandit was, I mean, this is one that, you know, I really felt put the Pontiac Trans Am, you know, I mean, it's one of the most recognized, you know, cars out there. And I can't tell you, you know, you drive anywhere Dawsonville North and you're guaranteed, I've seen like entire rigs of tractor trailers decked out like Bandit, you know, with, you know, I don't know if it's just for car shows or whatever, but I see a ton of, you know, the Pontiac Trans Ams.
You don't see that many like painted up, because I mean, that's the other thing about this movie too, it really brought trucker culture to mainstream America. And like I said, you don't really see the full rig murals anymore on trucks. They're all just like generic trailers, unless you're going to like a car show or NASCAR or something.
I almost feel like, you know, back in the day, you know, the full-on rig, that was, you know, the 1970s tattoo. You know, now you look at people's sleeves, and a lot of times they tell a story. But, you know, back then it was, you know, what's the biggest thing I have that, you know.
That's like, was it the famous basketball player, Karl Malone, the mailman? He became a trucker and had like a custom painted rig, too. But, like I said, something about the 70s and decorating your vehicles, kind of like the people that had the mural painted on the panel vans. This was the trucker version of the mural painted panel vans.
And you saw it a lot in, like, you know, El Caminos and stuff like that, too, on a smaller scale, you know, on the, like, tailgates and that type of thing.
Yeah. And recently, because I'm still behind on Walking Dead this season, but there is one season where they're, or one episode where they're, you know, out in the world, you know, wandering around. And there's a scene in front of, an abandoned, like, semi-trailer, and it's the freaking Smokey and the Bandit semi.
That's awesome.
I was like, that's a freaking funny little Easter egg for kids of the 70s that recognize that. But yeah, like you're saying, you know, because, you know, there's been, you know, several movies that are like associated with iconic vehicles, and, you know, the Smoking Bandit Trans Am too is one of those, you know, so recognizable vehicle, which is funny, is because you think, like, say Dukes of Hazzard. Every iteration of Dukes of Hazzard, it's still a 69 Charger. But with this,
it was whatever they can get.
It's a different car
on
in every movie. I mean, it's still a Pontiac Trans Am, but
pretty well, much. It stayed whatever year it was that year. It was a different car in each of the movies a lot of times. Like, I forgot how many, you know, vehicles. I mean, because the original film actually had two different generations of the Trans Am in it, and, you know, so, I mean,
but this also put, like, because, you know, the, you know, with the exception of, you know, maybe the GTO or the Judge, Pontiac was kind of known as like the knockoff Chevy. I mean, it was still a General Motors product, and the Trans Am was just pretty much a copy of the Camaro. It was like the Camaro clone. But when this movie came out, it's like, shit, sales probably eclipsed the 77 Camaro, because everyone wanted that freaking Firebird Trans Am.
I know I did. I mean, that was, you know, I don't know. You know, I don't know if it was the, you know, decorative hood, you know, or what it was. But, I mean, that car always stood out in my head. Like, you know, I wanted that over, you know, the General Lee or, you know, I mean, as far as performance cars would be concerned, I mean, you got Christine. We've talked about that.
I mean, they made, like, the T-top, too, like, super popular. Because those things, I remember one of my buddies had a car with T-tops, and those things always suck because they fucking leak.
Yes.
Like, eventually, they all fucking leak. But after smoking the Bandit, like, every early 80s Camaro or Trans Am, you had to get the freaking T-tops.
I mean, and pretty much any car I've ever had that had a sunroof or a moonroof on it, you know, you ran into that if you held on the car for an extended period of time.
Yeah, I just found it says, you know, because of this movie, the Pontiac Firebird outsold its Camaro counterpart for the first time ever.
Well, and you know, all right, so we're talking car sales there, but you know, let's talk about, you know, film grossing and budget, you know, and how successful this movie was. So to put it in comparison, this was the second highest grossing film of 1977, second only to Star Wars.
Yeah. It was like in 77, you're either seeing Star Wars or Smokey and the Bandit, or probably both.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And like I said, it was made for $4.3 million and made $300 million. I mean, that is huge in 1977 dollars. I mean, this movie, and it was originally supposed to be just a B-plot action movie where Jerry Reed was actually going to play the Bandit, and, you know, Hal was going to do it as this low-budget, you know, Mad Maxian, you know, film. And then his buddy Burt Reynolds read the script and loved it and wanted to come on. So they're like, well, we got an actual star involved now, so we need to, like, you know, put more money and a better script into it. And it became this iconic movie.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things I think that made this, the first one, you know, really so iconic is, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, freaking green screen, you know, style, you know, it was all, hey, you know, we're driving down the road. It looks like we're driving down the road. Like, yeah. And, you know, that and a lot of the stunts, yeah, there were a few that were pretty over the top, but it's like, it wasn't so over the top that it was just like unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. Some of those jumps, they definitely do the Dukes of Hazzard style where they cut away right as it lands so you don't see the car like fall completely apart. And then cut to them driving away going, ooh, we just made it. But you, you know, you ever watch Dukes of Hazzard, you know they never show the landing. They show the launch. The landing, they cut back to an interior of the car. Because, yeah, there's like, yeah. Those cars are not meant to jump. Really, you know, unless you're driving like a freaking, you know, rally car or some kind of like sport truck, you're nothing is really designed to jump.
No. It's not even designed for, I mean, a lot of cars, especially up north, just absolutely get shredded by potholes. I mean, it's designed for, you know, comfort and rideability, but yeah, it's not designed for performance and, you know, bottoming out your suspension, unless you've done some serious upgrades. But that's the expensive part of upgrading. Shit, you can upgrade an engine cheaper than you can doing suspension a lot of times.
Yeah, and like I said, and also too, but you know, now we're seeing this where Georgia has kind of become Little Hollywood now, where so many different things, you know, Marvel and whatnot being filmed here in Georgia. But back in the early 70s, like I said, it was, you know, Georgia wasn't, you know, the grand theater state that it is now. So this movie all being filmed in Georgia, as a Georgia boy, you know, Smokey and the Bandit had special, little special meaning because, you know, you could actually watch it and be like, I kind of know where that's at.
Yes.
These scenes, you know, now 40 years later, most of that stuff's grown over, but you're like,
but back, I mean, you can still see
back in the 80s when I was a kid watching this, I'm like, Oh, yeah, I know where that's at.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you can still see, oh, you know, they're out toward Buford Dam, or, you know, old parts of Gainesville, yeah, and stuff
or even
like that.
There's that one scene where somebody ends up going into a river, and there's a tow truck pulling a car out of the river, and the sheriff stops, sees what's going on, and a trucker drives by and knocks his door off. That's like a little gas station outside of Helen. I mean, it's like all over like the local like North Georgia area, and even and you know, our you know, as we get into it, the movie starts where Bandit is at a he's like a famous show off, and he's racing semi trucks. Apparently, semi truck rodeos and rallies and races were a thing back in the 70s.
I mean, that used to be a big thing. Even you know, I'll say that. You know, going to, you know, some of the, you know, drag races and stuff. I mean, you know, probably one of the coolest spectacles that I've seen are the, you know, freaking jet-powered semis. Like, yeah. Those are ridiculous.
But, like I said, all those scenes at the rodeo at the first of the movie and then the, you know, racetrack at the end of the movie are all filmed at the old Lakewood, Lakewood Fairgrounds, that if anybody's been to the old Lakewood Amphitheater, which I don't know, it's Best Buy, it changes names like yearly, but you know, if anyone's ever seen a concert,
Hi-Fi Buys, you know,
yeah, I think it's Best Buy now or something, but if anyone's ever been down there to see a concert, back in the day, you'd always see these grandstands in the field, like next to it, and that's, you know, where the old fairgrounds used to be, and that's where these scenes in the movie, in the old white roller coaster that was there that got torn down in the second movie. You know, I said at that point, I think it was already closed down, but they painted the roller coaster and made everything look like it was still functional and used it for this, you know, this movie scene.
Well, we're going to demo this thing anyway, so, you know, what better way than
yeah,
have a police chase up under it.
But yeah, the first movie is all about smuggling beers. So, yeah.
Gonna go get us 400 cases of Coors.
From Texarkana. Yeah, the bandit is approached by two good old boys that have a lot more money than they know what to do with. So they like making stupid bets. And they are betting all the local truckers that they can't go all the way out to Texas and get some beer and bring it back to Georgia in, what was it, 28 hours?
28 hours.
Because they needed beer to celebrate the Southern Classic race because they were sponsoring a driver. And for anybody who, from nowadays, they're like, why would you bother driving to Texas to get Coors Light? Well, back in the day, Coors Light was considered like the best beer because there was no preservatives. It was like unpasteurized, so you couldn't get it on the East Coast. They only shipped it so far from Texas, so it's like, or from Colorado, where so it's like you could not get it east of the Mississippi.
It's just like, you know, rewind a few years ago, and you couldn't find, even though it's the oldest brewery in the United States, I think, but you couldn't get Yuengling in the state of Georgia for so long.
Or Ledslinger's.
Or Ledslinger's.
And I remember me and Juice, like, you know, making a road trip up to Tennessee and smuggling back a couple of cases of Yuengling.
That doesn't really work, though, because technically you're allowed to bring back so many gallons. But
we had, like, a couple kegs, so it was... We're probably exceeding the travel amount, but we didn't have like 400 cases. We didn't require a semi. But yeah, it was like, yeah, you know, because that was one thing too, I was like, why? Because like now, Coors Light's almost considered just, you know, piss beer in the age of craft brewing. So I had to look it up, like, why was this a big deal? And they're like, oh yeah, this was like the greatest beer in the 70s. Like, in fact, like presidents used to have the Air Force smuggle them beer from like East Coast or West Coast bases. So they could have like beer at the Coors Light at the White House. I'm like, it's just kind of, you know, kind of crazy to think that back then that was like the world's greatest beer.
But I mean, you know, you look at I would still say that Coors is still very successful. I mean,
yeah,
you know, for folks like us that got more into craft markets and stuff, but I mean, there's still a lot of folks that's their everyday drinking beer, and they're going to drink that over any stout, porter, or any other style of beer out there. So, you know.
Silver Bullet.
Still better than Still Reserve.
Oh, God. That stuff is disgusting. And hell, I got to say, because usually you go to a sporting event, there's somebody selling Coors Light at every stadium race or whatever. And I got to say, it's not craft beer, but it still tastes better than like Bud Light to me. I mean, I'll drink a Coors Light if there's nothing else. I mean, no, I'm staying away from the Bud. I'm going to admit to my beer snobbery. I'm not drinking the Bud.
Yeah, but I mean, even then, as home brewers and such, I mean, to get a quality product like Bud Light, that many folks want to consume in mass quantity and everything is no small feat. So, yes, not my preferred drink, but still, that was kind of the gateway to, where we are today with beer. So, I'm not necessarily going to poo-poo all over it, but yeah.
Yeah, I admit I celebrated some Miller time back in the day before we got into good old MGD.
I was about to say, back in the day, it was all about the MGD. I mean, I can remember 48 packs galore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but eventually, as you get older, your taste buds, you want to, like I said, I drink less quantity and I drink more quality now. Oh, I can't remember the last time I did a 48 pack in a weekend or a night, depending on what kind
how
of
bad that week was.
Oh, yeah. But, in the course of smuggling this beer, they happened to stop and pick up a runaway bride played by Sally Fields, which 70 Sally Fields is freaking hot. I mean, she got that, like, girl next door look to her. And, of course, being the 70s, everybody needs a CB handle. They eventually name her Frog because she jumps around a lot.
Yes.
And she's cute like a frog, apparently, as the bandit describes. But unfortunately for them, that's why you never pick up hitchhikers. The wedding she's running away from is she's marrying the sheriff's son, who is, Texas Sheriff Buford T. Justice.
And that is Jackie probably Gleason. One of the... That role and the role of Bill Gillespie on Heat of the Night are probably two of the, most memorable sheriffs that I can, remember from either a television or from movies.
And both shot here in Georgia.
Yeah.
Jackie Gleason, may remember him from a little show called The Honeymooners and stuff. Being a Texas lawman does not believe in jurisdiction or borders and decides to chase the bandit all the way back to Georgia.
Well, I mean, he's been in high-speed pursuit.
I am in hot pursuit. Because he's like the stereotypical Southern sheriff. And I love there's one part they're going through, I forgot what town it is, and get tangled up with like their county police and the sheriff of that county is a very like well-spoken, educated man, and he's like, and they're on the radio, and he's like, "What are you doing?"
I'm apprised of the situation, sheriff. And he's like, "Got it under control."
He's like, "I'm in hot pursuit." And he's like, "Well, I'm apprised of the situation. We have it, under control. You're outside of your jurisdiction. We'll handle it from here." And he's like, "But I'm in hot pursuit. I'm Sheriff Buford T. Jesse, whatever." He's like, "Yes, sir, that's not germane to the situation." "What's the goddamn Germans got to do with anything?" Like one of my favorite lines.
Oh, my God. Yes, and it's the lines like that that, they etch something in the memory that just makes you chuckle every time. There's so many great one-liners from Smokey and the Bandit that, folks still reference today that, they're going to be endless, timeless.
Yeah, and, I've got a little family connection to the Smokey and the Bandit films because the scenes that were filmed here in Forsyth County along 400, my grandfather was a deputy sheriff back then, and he was actually... Jackie Gleason's kind of bodyguard on the set, and he's told us stories that apparently in his contract he was guaranteed a bottle of scotch every day, and at this time Cumming was a dry county, so Rod drove his car all the way to his patrol car to Atlanta to buy scotch for Jackie Gleason because this was the 70s and you could do that stuff back then. And I swear, when you watch that film, like a lot of his mannerisms and stuff, I think he straight stole from my grandfather. Because like, there's one scene where he gets stopped at, and a deputy starts chewing him out. And he gets out and just starts lecturing the guy about using phallic and poking him in the chest. I've seen my grandfather do that to people. It's like, I'm like, I just swear, like, freaking smoking, Jackie Gleason smoking the bandit is like a enhanced version of my grandfather.
Well, and that's, you know, I mean, I can...
They're even similarly sized men. It was...
You know, I mean, I can remember, you know, my uncles and stuff like that, you know, that either were, you know, and had some level of authority, whether it be military or law enforcement. But, you know, I can remember screwing up. And, I mean, that was the thing, is they would, you know, stand you toe to toe and it would be that finger to the chest the entire lecture. Like, and you would walk away and you'd be like, shit, I think my chest is bruised.
Oh, yeah. And he enjoyed to catch you right there where the pec muscle meets the shoulder muscle. That hurts like hell. I mean, he'd just, your freaking arm would go numb for a second. You'd just be walking by and be like, pop. And you're like, oh, son of a bitch.
Now that's an attention getter.
Yeah. But yeah, and yeah, let's talk a minute about the, well, with Sheriff, you get his idiot son, Junior Justice. Who is
turn
the...
left, Daddy.
Oh, he's like the...
Daddy, turn right.
Yeah, he was
whoa,
a bad
stop here, Daddy.
He was such an idiot through, like, all of these movies. And it's like, you know, him and, you know, Buford just provides such, like, the best comedic moments. And how much he is just exasperated with how stupid his son is.
There is no way you came from my loins.
I'm going to go home and slap your mama. Oh.
And that's kind of the, like... that always makes me wonder. I was like, what kind of mother would, you know, I could see very, you know, simpleton, you know, just, you know, probably not a, you know, violent bone in her body, just, you know, sweet as can be, you know, old lady as his mom.
An old southern lady, you know, and that makes everybody apple pie and stuff, and just the complete opposite to be fair.
Yes. I mean, because that was kind of the, you know, I guess the nuclear family dynamic in a way, I guess, at that time. But it was always, you know, I was like, just always wondered what kind of lady that would be. So in my head, that's her. Because yeah. I don't think in any of the movies it ever, you know, shows them,
yeah,
you know.
Even in the last one when he retires and moves the floor. I don't think they ever show. They show him like on the beach and doing retired people things, but I don't think they ever show the wife.
No.
But yeah, and then you have the people who started the whole quest, Big Enos and Little Enos,
which was just a weird dynamic in itself. I mean, just.
And it's funny, Little Enos, you know, played by Paul Williams, is a famous songwriter and composer. I mean, yeah. He's known for tons and tons of, like, big songs. But, I mean, even, you know, if you're not Looney Tunes, shit, Muppets fan, he's the one who wrote some of the, like some of the most famous Muppet songs, like
but
Rainbow,
you know,
Connection
what?
And
I mean, with the Jerry Reed and stuff like that, like, I'm, you know, I was actually surprised there isn't more people from kind of the music community and stuff, you know?
Yeah, and that was the thing, Jerry Reed, famous, you know, country singer, and then also, I believe Mel Tillis is in... You know, makes an appearance in either this one or the second. I know he's in the second one because he plays the guy who owns the circus grounds or whatever they go to. But yeah, like Jerry Reed was originally going to play the bandit himself, and then when Burt Reynolds came in, he got moved to the snowman role, and then wrote probably two of his most, you know, a couple of his most famous songs came out of this movie soundtrack. Like Eastbound, you know, anyone talks about Jerry Reed, despite of all the, you know, long career he had, music he made, Eastbound and Down is probably his most famous song.
Yeah.
So it kind of was lucky for him that he got put into the snowman role.
But I mean, you know, and let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, you know, you touched on it earlier that, you know, this film kind of helped bring truck culture to mainstream. But, you know, like, I've been watching some of the, you know, more modern reality, like trucking shows and stuff like that. And, you know, it definitely seems to be that, you know, that's kind of a over and done culture. I mean, I can remember, you know, it wasn't uncommon for everyday cars to have CB radios, and you'd be on long road trips, you know, talking with truckers and, you know, listening to, you know, stories and that type of thing.
In the day and age of smartphones and stuff, I'm wondering if, you know, well, I know people, I don't know anyone who still has a CB in their car other than, you know, police and like, you know.
Well, I mean, you see it with, you know, some of the good old boys and stuff that do off-roading and that type of thing. So, I mean, it's not completely non-existent, but it's definitely not as common as it once was.
I mean, truckers still use them because, you know, they still need to communicate between, you know, themselves and stuff out on the road. Because, I mean, I stopped at a couple of truck stops on my recent road trip to Ohio, and they still sell CB supplies in truck stops, so it's still a thing. But it's not as popular because I remember having a CB, my grandfather having a CB in his truck when we were kids, and you know, talking to you know, when we're on, like, when we would go hunting and have, like, you know, a couple truckloads of guys, you know, all of us talking to each other along the road, and also you know, listening in on the trucker talk and talking to them occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember me and one of my buddies as a kid, you know, we would go down to his dad's basement, and his dad, you know, had a CB radio set up on his workbench, you know, right beside the police scanner and stuff. And, you know, we'd get on there being stupid punk-ass kids and, you know, be talking to people. Yeah, who knows where the hell they were, but
the CB radio was early podcasting. Yeah. Because, I mean, people used to get on and just board on the road. They got like a,
hey, be on this channel from this time to this time, and we're going to talk about life. And
yeah, like how when we talked about Big Trouble in Little Chinatown, you know, you know, he kind of was doing like a little CB radio show as he was driving across country. Because I mean, when you're spending 18-20 hours in a vehicle, you got to have something to do. So these little truckers had their own CB radio shows, like I said, early podcasting of the 70s.
But I mean, not only that, but then too, you know, just the handles and stuff like that. I mean, they just, you know,
snowman
little beaver.
Even the bandit was actually a call sign, because his real name was Bo Durham.
Yeah.
And the cowboy hat too. I mean, because like I said, this was a very, like, oh, the truckers of the 70s were the modern day cowboys, you know. And, you know, especially Bandit, you know, always have that, you know. In fact, I love that line where they stop for a minute and to take a walk, and they're talking. She's like, "Do you ever take that hat off?" He's like, "I only take it off for one thing." And she's like,
"Well, two things. One was sleeping."
And then sleeping. and then she's like, pauses for a minute. She's like, "Oh, take your hat off." "Yes, ma'am."
But I mean, I think that dynamic, you know, between the bandit and, you know, Sally's character is, you know, really kind of what brought, you know, I think if it was just, hey, we're on the road and these are the shenanigans, like, but you add in the actual story arc and the dynamic of everything, and I think that's what allowed, you know, this film to be so successful.
Yeah, because those are two such different characters. I mean, he's like a old country boy.
I mean, I'm just the typical show-off, and I'm the straight-laced dancer, and I want to be on Broadway, and...
Yeah. Oh, and...
But I'm
the
a little
stress
bit
of the situation, you know, and she's definitely got a little thing for bad boys, apparently, and, you know, shenanigans ensue. But that brings us to the next installment and the next version of the Bandit Trans Am, because they jumped from a 77 to like an 80 Trans Am, which was a little bit more colorful. It wasn't just a single color bird. The bird was like, you know, had multicolors and the fancy gold rims and stuff, and a son of Trigger, because Yeah, this one came out in 1980, made for 17 mil, only made 66, I mean, which was still successful, but not as hugely successful as the original. And in this one, Big Enos and Little Enos are now running for Texas governor.
Yes.
And so to try to get in the good graces, they find out the governor of Texas, they're trying to get the endorsement of the governor of Texas. So they find out that he's having trouble getting a package that's stuck in the docks somewhere in Florida. So they hire the bandit and snowman and offer him like a buttload of money to get this crate to Texas before the Republican National Convention. Well, yeah, but apparently in the ensuing years, you know, that's one thing too. Cause like at the end, when the bandit finally gets there with the beer, they're like double or nothing, go to Boston or New England and bring us back some clam chowder. And they're like, so apparently they won the bet because you see Snowman is now like racing trucks and has like a brand new rig that would have cost a lot of money. But Bandit, unfortunately, Fred has left him and he's become an alcoholic. So Snowman takes the bet and then he has to spend a couple days sobering up the Bandit and they find out he has like sold the Trans Am. He's like, he's the only man I know that could drink a Trans Am.
Well, and you know, and I think for me, you know, like, from the first film to the opening of the second film, I think off the bat, that's one of the things I didn't like. Because that's, you know, to me, did not at all fit the bandit, you know, personality or anything else. You know, like, at no point did it allude that, you know, he has the propensity to, you know, be a raging alcoholic. Like,
But yeah, apparently he tried to become a country singer and that failed and Fred left him and went back to Junior Justice and has to escape on a wedding again because, yeah, freaking Snowman offers a bunch of money to help him sober up
Fred
Bandit.
Or Frog?
A frog.
Yeah, there we
Fred.
Go. I'm like,
Fred was the dog.
Fred was the dog.
It was an F word.
But, all right, so we got to talk about Fred because Fred plays an interesting role. Like,
yeah,
I mean, you got an overweight basset hound that just...
Which is probably the perfect dog to, like, drive cross country with, because I couldn't have my pit bull in the car. That thing would be, like, jumping all over the place in a car for 18 hours. But a freaking basset hound just wants to lay there and sleep and be fat. That's what, pretty much what they do.
Occasionally go for a swim.
And bite a biker.
I don't believe my dog bit you, sir. Oh, what was that? What did he refer to the biker bar as? A skull nest?
I don't remember.
Something like that.
I know the roadside diner was a choke and puke.
Yeah, because in the second movie, they pull up to another, you know, establishment of sorts. And, yeah, I think it's a skull nest is what he refers to it as.
But yeah, this movie, I mean, they also brought in Dom DeLuise as a Italian doctor, kind of, you know, Bert's sidekick from the Cannonball Run days. And, you know, I've always liked them two together in movies. I mean, they're always funny, him and Dom DeLuise. But, yeah, they have to buy him a new Trans Am because he sold the other one for beer because he was an alcoholic. And, yeah, and like I said, they find out that this package that they're taking is actually an elephant.
Yes.
And shenanigans ensue, because transporting live cargo that size is a little bit more difficult.
Well, and it was kind of weird, too, because they're still using that boxed-in trailer, not a trailer that you would typically associate, hey, I'm moving livestock or, you know, a live animal in. And it's, you know, like I guess for me that's kind of the funny part was, you know, it's like, well, how do we get an elephant into the trailer? And it's like, oh, well, hey, Charlotte, get in this trailer.
Oh, okay.
And it just steps right up like, all right, so you got a circus elephant that's already trained, as luck would have it.
Yeah, yeah. But unfortunately, she's pregnant, and that causes some setbacks in the transportation of said elephant. And it's really about him trying to redeem himself. He's like, I'm kind of washed up. I want to get back to the old bandit. And, you know, this is probably my last attempt to do something that makes me famous, because my fame that I achieved early on is kind of
worn
off.
Well, I think he, pretty much screwed his reputation, too, because I think he became, a bit of a bastard in, his...
his ego started writing checks his ass couldn't cash. And like I said, this, and of course, you know, Fred has gone back to Junior. So when, and is at her wedding.
Frog.
When fuck, Frog.
Can we just start saying Carrie?
Yeah, Carrie. So she bails again. And so, you know.
Buford's Junior, you love me, right?
Like, I'm going to make us a lot of money and I'll be right back. Okay, Carrie.
It's like, oh, the entire time. Buford T is standing in the back like, this bitch is about to run out and I know it. Like,
and draws down on her and stuff. But yeah.
It's like, where are you going? The bandit needs me.
And I like in this one, they've added the fact that apparently Buford has developed a little bit of a stress issue. So now he has like a hot heart monitor watch he bought on a TV advertisement that beeps whenever his heart rate gets too high. So he has to say these this meditation stuff.
The woosah of
it was like anybody seen Bad Boys 2? It's the woosah. He's like om om until his heart rate monitor goes down. But yeah, he tracks him to Florida and tries to stop the bandit from even making it out of the docks with the elephant, and then hot pursuit ensues. But this movie, like I said, it's on second watching, it's not as good as the original, but it has its moments. Like there's some parts that gets ridiculous. Like, for instance, when they first see each other again, he's like, you know, bandit just kind of plays the sheriff's ego to get away, and he's like, I bet you can't even hit me from way over there. And he's like, I'll let you know I'm a crack shot. And he's like, see those like three light bulbs over there? And he's like, yeah, you know, just from like hip fires, and hits like every single one, which is pretty badass. And he's like, well, that's mighty impressive, Sheriff, but what really impressed me is if you shoot those signs over there. And he's like, all right. And ends up emptying his gun. So,
but I mean, like, at the same time, like, you know, I
yeah, he's kind of planning ahead, because he's like, Junior, hand me your gun, because I know what he's going to do. Yeah. As soon as I run out of ammo, he's going to try to take off. So when that happens, he grabs Junior's gun and it's like, click. He's like, why is your gun not loaded? He's like, well, the gun gets too heavy when it has bullets in it, Daddy. Yes. Said it once and I'll say it again. There is no way you're my son.
But I mean, you know, I think the dynamic between the bandit and, you know, Buford T is one of the things that really helps, you know, because at the end, you know, of the first movie, you know, you kind of see the bandit, you know, pull up beside the sheriff, and it's like, you know, hey, Sheriff, we're headed up to Boston to get some clam chowder, you know.
Because they've kind of developed that mutual respect. Because at this point, through the first movie, he never, well, he meets the bandit, but he doesn't know he's the bandit. So they have this conversation in the truck stop or the thing. But when they get there, he's like calling him on. He's like, I've got you. Nah, there's no way out. And he's like, all right, yeah, I just want to say, before I tell you where I'm at, you are the most, you know, dedicated lawman I've ever had the pleasure of running from. And he's like, and you are the most, you know, aggravating suspect
pursuit
ever.
Pursuit-y.
You know, like, and I got to give you some respect too. He's like, all right, I'm down at the bottom of the hill. I'm in a cowboy hat, and I got a little
over your
midget
shoulder.
Dressed just like me. And he's like, all right. And he's like, can't do it, Sheriff. I respect you too much. Just look over your left shoulder. And he looks over, and there he is. He's like, we're going to Boston to get some clam chowder. Try to keep up. Oof. But even in this, even though he's like, I've got to catch you, he's just that, you know, little bit of respect they have for each other, because he's like, no one has been this determined to catch me.
But I mean, I think it also, you know, that mutual respect just, you know, really plays through, because I think the sheriff is probably, you know, right there on the brink of retirement. So this is, you know, his last, you know, real, you know, hey, I want to hold on to all these years.
Yeah, and he's a man who has caught everyone he's gone after. He's like, you know, and he's like, the bandit getting away is just a slight, you know, ding on his reputation that he doesn't want to have follow him around. So, yeah, it's like...
But I got to say, where he decides to retire in Florida with the beach house and everything else is not at all where I would anticipate Sheriff Justice retiring to, because he is so out of his element.
Oh, yeah. Well, once we get into that third movie, like, I expect him a cabin in the woods type of guy, not...
it's like, give me a range, or, you know...
Yeah. But, and, you know, eventually think. But yeah, this, like I said, once you get to some of the later scenes where it just got ridiculous, we're like, you know what? We got money now because we made so much money on the first one. Let's just spend a lot of it doing dumb shit. And like, you know, toward the end of the movie, you get the, you know, Buford decides that he needs backup. So he calls his cousin Gaylord and I forget what the other guy's name was, but one of them was a Canadian lawman and one of them was like a Texas Ranger. So he gets all these like Canadian, you know, Mounties and Texas Rangers. And they're all played by all three brothers are played by Jackie Gleason. And they show up and they you know, lure Bandit in by,
So it was Reginald Van Justice, and then it was, who was it? And then Gaylord.
So. Yeah. But yeah, they mess with Bandit's ego. That's what always gets him in trouble. And it's like, hey, Bandit, if you make a turn down this road, there is no way you're getting away. He's like, well, I'll take your challenge. And he gets there, and there's like 300 cop cars chasing him around this, like, old rock quarry or something out in the middle of the desert. And then Snowman shows up with his own army of truckers. And then there's a whole like freaking demolition derby thing going on. That got a little ridiculous.
Well, all right. So, you know, talking about some of the stunts. So remember way back when in the very first Fast and the Furious movie, everybody made a big deal when the, you know, car travels under the 18-wheeler and is, you know, coasting. Well, yeah. That stunt was done in the original Smokey and the Bandit. Just nobody probably remembers it. Like, I can remember people like, yeah, they had to make all kinds of custom trailers and everything else for that car. I'm like, yeah, the Bandit did it, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, but yeah, that whole sequence got ridiculous. That and the other thing, other than the, like I said, those ridiculous stunt sequence sort of the end, is the more use of like special effects in this one. Because in the original one, the scenes where they're in the car talking to each other, you can clearly see that, you know, hell, the car may be on a trailer being towed, but they're shooting in a moving vehicle. Where in this one, you know,
it looked like a lot of green screen.
Yeah, technology's not up to the point it is today. So there's like those inside the car sequences look like they were shot on a sound stage, because you could definitely tell it was like, you know, video going by and not actual scenery.
They were just moving that fast, man. That fast.
And then you get into the final one. That Burt Reynolds and Sally Fields were smart enough not to return for.
Even
the director was smart enough not to return for this one, because this one was directed by Dick Lowry. Made for $9 million, only made $7 million. Oh, yeah, this was
like... So they cut down on the special effects and the, you know, acting budgets, but... Yeah.
But this one is like so bad.
I think it's bad from the aspect of there was a certain dynamic that the first film really brought. The second one tried to elude and bring into the mix, but you know, this film here, all that was lost, you know. Yeah. And it kind of sucked because, you know,
and there's really not a whole lot of continuity to them. It's almost like a series of skits that they've tied together. Because in this one, Buford has retired, and Big Enos and Little Enos now are just kind of bored and decide to make stupid bets. And they're like, let's make a bet with the sheriff, you know, like, you know, pretty much try to turn him into the Bandit. And they're like, you know, he's at his retirement party, and it looks like the opening scenes from Patton, him in front of a giant American flag. And they're like, well, you never caught the Bandit, you know, and all that stuff. So, you know, there's a tarnish on your record. And they're like, you know, if you want to try one more time, you know, we'll make a bet with you. So he finally, after a couple days or weeks of retirement, he's like just so bored out of his mind. It's like, all right, we got to call it. Which that happens to a lot of guys, you know, that are used to an action-packed, you know, existence. And then go to retire. And it's just like, I'm bored now. I got to do something. Yeah. So they take the bet with Big Enos and Little Enos, that he's like, all right, we want you to drive...
This is part of a marketing campaign.
Yeah, you need to drive this stuffed fish from Florida to Texas in a certain amount of time, and if you get there, we're going to give you a shitload of money. And then they just try to, like, booby-trap them and set them up throughout, you know, through the whole trip.
Which is kind of weird, because, you know, in the... the first two films, you know, yeah, Bigginess, Littleness, they're backing all the funds and everything else, but they don't directly try to interfere or anything else. But this one just turns into a truly kind of cat and mouse, you know.
Yeah, and like I said, it's just like a series of skits with them playing pranks on the sheriff, trying to keep him from making it to Texas. And it gets to the point where none of their traps have worked, so they're like, well, we need to distract him. We got to call the one guy we can always count on. And they're like, the bandit, like, hell no, his ego's too big to deal with. We got to, you know, deal with the real man that we can depend on. So they call the snowman and pay him to pretend to be the bandit to distract the sheriff.
And he goes as far as to dress and get the mustache.
Oh,
and
Jerry Reed with a mustache looks like he should be driving a windowless panel van.
Yes.
I mean, he does not look good with a mustache. And, like, of course, we get a new Bandit Trans Am, which now it's like an 84 Trans Am. It looks like Knight Rider. It's like Kit with a Firebird logo on the hood. It's the exact same year as the freaking Kit car. I kept waiting for it to be like, you know, hit turbo boost, snowman.
But, you know, but the fact that they try to do every scene or replicate every scene from the first movie, you know, so it you know.
Yeah, he picks
instead
up
of Sally
hitchhiker.
Fields, now we get Dusty Tails. Well, she's not even a hitchhiker. So basically, you know, she works at a used car dealership, I'm assuming. And once again, this, you know, being 1980, you know, era, you know, it's obvious that, you know, the guy is just a predator and a sleazeball, like so many car, dealership folks. Anyway, she has enough of it, and she's like, this guy is going to rip you off, and blah, 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 and, you know, ends up walking out, you know, in the middle of filming their, you know, commercial or whatever the case is, and that's when we get, you know, her picked up. But, you know, she tries to do the whole wardrobe change and everything else. Like, it was that to a T all over again. It's like, it doesn't have the same feel or genuality or anything else.
Yeah, and then there's such silly scenes where they try to make him look like a badass. There's like one where they stop to get food, and he goes into this biker bar and gets in a fight. You never see what's going on inside the bar. He walks in, he gets beat up, thrown out, and he's like, hey, I just come out to see you know, if you wanted pickles on your burger. Yeah, give me. And goes back in, gets thrown out again.
You want mustard on that?
Yeah, and then finally, like the third or fourth time he's gone in, he finally beats the shit out of everybody and comes out with the food.
But, you know, and once, you know, I mean, it was, you know, because you have him in the bar fight in the first movie, and obviously he gets his butt kicked, and, you know, it's, you know, Bandit gets him on the CB and like, well, I had a little bit of a run-in, and, you know, Snowman, you know, is like, you know, I did about my usual. It's like, ah, okay, well, you must have lost.
Yeah, it.
But now take it on the Bandit persona. Apparently, he's learned to defend himself.
I mean, he's, you know, operates by keep asking himself, "What would the Bandit do in this situation?" And I think that even at one point she's
WWBD.
I think at one point she even asked, like, you know, what would the Bandit do at this point? Well, all right, then we'll do this. And like I said, he does steal the
Bandit would jump it.
Yeah, because apparently they made a similar bet with him, so he's trying to steal the fish from Buford to get it to the party, and at one point they stop for the night, and it's in the sleazy sex motel. Yes. And the sheriff and Junior come in to try to find him, and they're just room to room of debauchery.
But I guess to me, you know, and I don't know if I mentioned this on air yet or not, but this third film, for some reason, Junior is probably one of my favorite characters. You know, just because of his oblivious, innocent nature, and, you know.
Yeah, innocent Junior in a sex motel is kind of amusing. And even the sheriff meets him freaking S&M chick or something who's like, you know, now in love with him. Because he handcuffs her, thinking she's a bandit, because she's wearing
up, you know,
in a steam room wearing a cowboy hat, and she kind of likes that thing and just follows him through the rest of the movie.
And who is Faith Minton is, you know, and I don't think this woman ever has a name or anything, but yeah, it's just so over the top.
Yeah, and eventually, like, you know, Snowman kind of figures out what's going on, and he's like, you know, after all we've done to the sheriff, I'm gonna let him win this one, yeah, and you know, lets him get the, you know, slows down enough where the sheriff can pull up and snatch the fish out of the car, and then she's like, why are you slowing down? He's like, hell, I gotta slow down so he can catch up, and allows him to win the bet. You know, kind of final gift to the sheriff, and you know, they even pull up, and she's like, what are you doing? We gotta get out of here. And he's like, you know, this cost me like $80,000. You know, I gotta see this moment to him finally. You know, a combination of letting the sheriff finally win one, and also sticking it to the the Enises. And then that's when the sheriff's like, there he is. You know, kind of like the Wile E. Coyote finally catching the Roadrunner. He's like, I finally caught the bandit. And it's the one cameo that, you know, Bert has in the movie. Cause he's just like, oh my God, what are we going to do? Cause the car won't start. And he's like, just let me handle this. And he turns around and talks to the sheriff. And when Snowman turns around, it's actually Bert Reynolds. And he's like, you know, we've had a long, you know, run, sheriff, and I'm kind of going to miss running from you. And I know as a lawman that has, you know, I think in retirement, you're going to miss chasing me and whatever. And he's like, how about we just have one last run? And he's like, well, I can't really do that, bandit. You know, it's against the rules. And then his son says something stupid. And he's like, tell you what, I'll give you a 10-minute head start. Let's do this. So yeah, it's like I said, that, you know, that dynamic of them two together, just like, you know, that scene's probably one of the coolest parts of a very bad movie.
Yes. But I mean, I gotta say, it is kind of fitting that, you know, for some reason Junior ends up with all the money.
Yeah.
And you know,
Dad drives off with the girl, and he's like chased him with a bag full of money.
So money's just going everywhere. So it's like, well, you had the reward money, and your son done screwed up and lost all the reward money, and now you got a nymphomaniac riding shotgun.
Not a bad retirement.
I don't know. It's just kind of scary.
So as we wrap this up, do you have any particular highlights of Smokey and the Bandit, or particular favorite characters or moments?
I mean, I think probably one of my favorite moments, you know, goes back to the first movie, and, you know, they're in the middle of the high speed pursuit, and then, you know, an 18 wheeler is backing up across the road, and, you know, Buford looks over to his son, it's like, you better duck or you're going to be missing your head. And, you know, anyway, it takes the roof off as they drive under the trailer and stuff. And Junior, Daddy, the roof came off.
Like, no,
just so stupid that it's hilarious. I don't know. You know, that and just the whole, you know, dynamic of, you know, Sheriff being like, hold my hat. And, you know, son is holding his hat. But, Daddy, my hat blew off. Luckily, your head wasn't.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, that decapitating the car scene. I've seen that, like, replayed in so many different movies.
Yes.
That's like, that is a gag that has lasted the years. And, yeah, like I said, of course, Bandit's the star. But, you know, Buford T. Jess is probably just one of my favorite characters. And then the Snowman, you know. Yeah, Jerry Reed is like, yeah, as,
I mean,
the Snowman,
he's got some really great moments,
yeah.
You know, where,
and even like in the second one where Bandit is just obsessed with winning this bet at all costs, because he's kind of lost his, you know, his heart, and he's trying to regain his fame at all costs, and Snowman has to step up and be like the moral compass of the group and be like, I love you, man, but I'm going to knock you the fuck out if we don't, like, you know, stop, if we don't get this, you know, take care of this elephant.
Yeah. And well, and I you know, I think that was, you know, a really cool dynamic, you know, in that sense, where, you know, Sally or Carrie, you know, obviously has, you know, an appreciation of animals, and Snowman's like, hey, we need to look after our best interests, and the fact that they just happen to, you know, interrupt this gynecologist in the middle of having lunch. Just,
yeah, when it's your best friend punching you in the face, you know you fucked up. I mean, it was like that moment of like,
but you know
that's the only one that can get through with him and tell him you're fucking up. Like, this is the level we've gotten to, where, like, you know, and then that kind of, knocks some sense into him, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I am an asshole. I've got it took Snowman get to that point of being pissed off to finally Bennett realize like, oh yeah, I've fucked up my life, and I need to make some different choices."
Yeah, because I mean that was. You know, just really cool how that played out. You know, it was good to see, you know, but yeah, I mean, you know, he had a, you know, ton of just great lines. I mean, you know, one of the first, you know, scenes I think that made me laugh is when Sally Field, you know, gets in the, you know, Bandit's car and the wedding dress and stuff. And, you know, she's taking it off while Jerry Reed's, you know, traveling behind and getting hit with, you know, some of the clothing and stuff. And, you know, just gets on the radar and's like, you know, well, what you wearing now? Like, come back.
Is that woman wearing a wedding dress? And she just throws the wedding dress out the window. And he's like, what you wearing now? Come back. Yeah. No, I'm serious. What you wearing now?
I mean, just.
Oh. And then, like, the third movie where he finally gets to play the bandit. And there's that opening sequence where he's just, like, so over the top happy. Like, I get to be the bandit. I get to be the bandit. And he's so. That probably almost real life. Because he was originally cast to play the bandit and got replaced by Burt Reynolds. So I think the character's reaction and his reaction probably like paralleled each other. That's probably why he signed up for this bad movie. It was like, I finally get to play the bandit. I'm the one that gets to drive the car and get the girl.
Maybe, you know, but I mean, that to me was just cool. You know, we talk about, you know, some of the other films where they got, you know, 80s gear up montages and everything. Well, this was the bandit montage. And, you know, I got to say, like, it put a smile on my face to see that dude so happy. Yeah. Like, I mean.
He just looks horrible with the Reynolds mustache.
Yeah, he could definitely do without the mustache. I mean, the only other guy I can think that may be happier than, you know, Jerry Reed finally playing the bandit would be the homeless guy that we were able to
we gave alcohol at drag
assist in, you know.
Yeah. Oh, so what do you think of this cigar here as we wrap up?
The cigar has been pretty good to me. You know, it's lasted longer than I thought it would. I mean,
yeah, we're in a little over an hour into this thing, and I still got at least half a cigar, if maybe a little bit less than that. I'm definitely into the final third, but yeah, for a smaller cigar, it's definitely got a nice slow burn. It's not going to be a quick smoke as other cigars of this size.
But you know, the flavors, like as I've smoked more of the cigar,
it doesn't taste like roadkill.
Well, I haven't had roadkill to compare, so you know, I feel a little bit disadvantaged not being able to answer more thoroughly. And
you put enough hot sauce, anything's edible.
but it seems to have mellowed out quite a bit. You know, I would definitely say that, you know, I would put this at a medium. You know, it's lost, you know, that original, you know, peppery, you know, taste that I was getting initially.
Yeah. Where the regular flat tends to be a powerhouse throughout, the still horse, it definitely has that strong kick up front. But when you get into that final third, it kind of mellows out a little bit, you know, and, you know.
This tastes very much
relaxing toward the end.
You know what this reminds me of now is the CAO, the Brazilian, you know, because I'm getting.
Well, it does have that Brazilian binder in there.
You know, and that's what I feel like I'm getting right now. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting that it's almost like two cigars in one.
Yeah. And with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
He's pounded down, loaded up and trucking. Are we going to do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound just like no bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal. Some never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got a run to make. The boys are thirsty in Atlanta, and there's beer in Texarkana, and we'll bring it back no matter what it takes. Eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound just
Hey, man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back to the show. It's time for Beer 30. And to kind of go along with our, you know, Smokey and the Bandit smuggling beer theme, this week's beer did not come from our usual supplier, Dawson Fine Wines. This was actually picked up on a road trip to Ohio and brought back to us, Smokey and the Bandit style, for us to sample this week. So what are we drinking, Brad?
So we're drinking Great Lakes Brewing Company's Edmund Fitzgerald Porter. And, you know, we hadn't done too many porters, so, you know, it's good to have something, you know, different. And, you know, this is actually local to the Cleveland, Ohio area. But, you know, this beer is renowned for, you know, it's a 12-time medal winner since 1991. You know, it's...
Yeah, Great American Beer Festival Awards, 5-time medal winner, World Beer Champions... Championships, 12-time medal winner, world champion, platinum, gold, and silver, and also gold and silver at the Great American Beer Festival Awards. So it's very award-winning beer.
Yeah, you know, and with this, so you're going to get notes of bittersweet, you know, chocolate, coffee. You know, one of the things that I loved is, you know, unlike so many, you know, brewery sites is, you know, they include a lot of information as far as the beer and exactly what's in the bottle. So, you know, this goes as far as to, you know, all the malts, the different varieties of hops that are used. You know, so a lot of great information, you know, to tailor to your specific, you know, flavor profiles and what you enjoy in beer.
Yeah, 6% ABV, 37 IBU. And another thing, too, kind of to tie it into Smokey and the Bandit and Jerry Reed, old school country music always tend to tell a story. And, like, you know, there's these great country ballads. And a famous country ballad is the Ballad of the Edmund Fitzgerald that tells the story of, you know, the freighter, the Edmund Fitzgerald, who went down in the Great Lakes and lost, you know, 29 of her crew. And, you know, there was, I can't remember who wrote the song, but there's a famous country song called The Ballad of Edmund Fitzgerald. In fact, on the bottle, it says, you know, pairs well with oysters, bitter chocolate, and epic ballads.
Yeah, and actually, you know, on, you know, some of the label artwork, they actually, you know, use the Faded Freighter's handwritten ship name, you know, by the ship's first mate and the number 29 to represent the crew who lost their lives. So,
and another cool thing on their website, if you know, not only does it, you know, give you some kind of recommended pairings, but if you scroll down and actually give, they actually have some of you that like to cook with beer, they have a couple recipes using the Edmund Fitzgerald beer. If you wanted to try one, they got a recipe for barbecue baked beans, Edmund Fitzgerald braised corned beef nachos, and Edmund Fitzgerald pepper steak soup. So yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I mean, you know, that's one of the aspects. I mean, you hear people do beer can chicken and stuff like that, but I mean, you know, beer with beans and, you know, all types of you know, stuff there for the you know, culinary minded.
Yeah, they even give, like, recommendations on other beers you should try based on this beer. Like, if you like this beer, try this, this, and this. It's kind of cool. And like I said, of all the brewery websites we've looked at, this one probably has the most information available to anyone who really likes to, who are beer nerds like us and likes to dive deep in the information of their beer. But yeah, it definitely has a good, like, little chocolate coffee notes to it. Mmm.
Yeah, so this will actually, you know, consist of the number 29, the, you know, handwritten, you know, letter, you know, the canvas, as well as the lightning that, you know, captures the intensity and power of the storm and stuff. So a lot of cool history going on, you know, with just the bottle artwork. So I don't know. I think that's really awesome.
And another thing, too, this, you know, I guess the way they make this beer is not one that's meant to to age. So, like, yeah, they say for the freshest, definitely drink it within, you know, 180 days of it going on the shelf. And so, you know, it's not loaded with freaking preservatives and whatnot like some of your mass-produced, macro brewery beers.
So I got to say, this is a damn good beer. I'm at a 4.75. Fuck it.
Yeah.
Like, it's really good.
Like I said, we've, you know, tend to go, you know, more towards stouts. And basically stout is a porter. It's just a stouter porter. That's how they came up with the name of stout. But, you know, it tends to be more chocolatey, where porters tend to be more coffee flavored. Yeah, this is a damn good example of a porter. Like I said, it's one of those I don't drink very often, but I probably should, because this is really good beer.
Good. Yep.
And with that, we'll be right back.
Yes, science!
And welcome back to the podcast. It's time for some science! Ready to learn all there is to learn in the cyberverse today?
Let's go for it, man.
Let's break out some science like some Tony Stark shit on you.
So we're going to talk about flying suits and thrusters and...
Sure, I did see somebody had built a flying suit, sort of. it was very like Iron Man Mach 1. Yeah, I kept waiting for him to like crash into the, you know, through the roof of the garage. But speaking of robots and such, scientists at the Center for Fetal Disease and Treatment at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has recently been experimenting with a robotic womb. So we're one step closer to the Matrix.
Sweet.
So now when the robots eventually take over, they can put us in artificial wombs and, you know, use us as batteries. That was like the whole plot of Matrix, right?
Yeah, sort of. I don't know. It kind of reminds me of Aliens a little bit. Like, instead of, you know, the freaking eggs, we're going to go into wombs.
Or like in, was it Blade Trinity when they were farming the humans and had them in those little sacks?
Yep.
That's a lot what this new device looks like. Basically, you know, the problem is with premature births, you know, there's, you know, 50% chance that there's, you know, there is going to be some kind of, like, you know, health problems later on. You know, most of these kids that are born prematurely have like a 90% mortality rate. And scientists have been working ways to kind of increase the time in the womb. So even if they are born premature, they're trying to develop better ways of extending the developmental process without, you know, the technology we have today, which is, you know, incubators and stuff like that, that doesn't really help the situation. So they've recently been experimenting with an artificial womb they've built, and they've been able to maintain premature lamb fetuses for up to a month in these artificial robotic wombs that basically imitate... It's basically a plastic sack-like thing filled with a imitation amniotic fluid that, you know, mimics the conditions of an actual womb.
That's pretty cool. I mean... I don't know. I mean, I could see that definitely being a huge, you know, step forward. I don't know. I'm curious to see what the results continue to have and, you know, further success. But, I mean, to me, it like you said, it makes so much more sense, you know, because here you're in that controlled environment, that type of thing, more so than just an incubator where, all right, we can kind of keep you warm and feed you oxygen, but...
Yeah, especially at that, like, stage of development, they can't really, you know, the lungs and stuff aren't ready to be exposed to the environment yet. So if they can recreate the conditions that they're supposed to be in, even if it is for just a month, that's, you know, a month more development than they would have had, and are, you know, their survival rate and, you know, health status will probably
say that
definitely
it,
increase.
Know, I mean, yeah, definitely a step in the right direction, and, you know, I don't know, you know, I mean, like you said, that month could be, you know, the difference between, you know, living and, you know, unfortunately, you know, dying, I guess. Not really any way to beat around the bush or...
Yeah, well, more lighthearted news here. Study shows that chili peppers and marijuana are actually good for your gut.
I mean, I think, you know, medicinally speaking, marijuana is getting a much better reputation, you know, as, you know, we've now pumped ourselves full of chemicals and, you know, pharmaceutical aids instead of all natural products. It's like, oh, well, here's something that has benefit and doesn't have all those nasty long-term side effects, addictions, and everything else. And I'm a chili fan. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always eating hot shit. So now it's, yeah. Hey, I'm actually doing this for, yeah, to better myself.
Well, you know, in fact, I was having this conversation last night. You know, I bought that ghost pepper salsa and had somebody try it. And it's hot. And we got on the topic of, you know, it's a great way to clear out your sinuses and prevent colds and stuff like that is, you know, hot sauce and, you know, chili style foods in general.
Yeah, so scientists in recently published a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And they found that the, you know, basically the thing in peppers that make them hot, capsaicin, they have been studying with that and found that mice fed the spice had less inflammation in their guts. They said the hot stuff actually, you know, binded with a receptor called TRPV1 and produced a chemical called anandamide, however you pronounce it, which is a kind of a natural, you know, inflammatory or deflammatory. Whatever, it helps inflammation in the gut. And they were actually able to cure mice of type 1 diabetes using peppers.
So basically then, so the, you know, capsaicin, when it binds molecularly to the TRPV1, you know, basically produces the same compound, you know, very similarly to cannabis.
Yeah, it's like the cannabinoids in marijuana and whatnot had a similar... So once they found, you know, or the chemical makeup of the chemical that's being produced by the hot peppers was similar to this chemical found in marijuana, and since they had such success treating the mice with hot shit, they moved the experiment to Colorado where they could get some legal weed and found it had a very similar effect in, you know, helping and curing some kind of some digestive diseases and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, as the downfall of spicy foods can absolutely have some, you know, very bright upsides. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, I used to suffer from really bad allergies and stuff. Well, you know, since I started eating more spicy foods, my allergies aren't, you know, as severe as they once were. Now, you know, some of that could be that I'm getting peppers and stuff that are locally grown. So some folks are like, well, you know, they're probably getting pollinated by the local pollen and you're developing immunity. But, you know, for me, you know, like if I feel I've got something sinus related coming on, I'll do it, you know, I mean, not ghost peppers, but, you know, I'll do a couple shots of Tabasco or something like that. And
hey, I'm of the theory, if something hot's good, something really hot has to be better. Yeah. That's my secret to mortality. I may have the flaming shits, but I'm going to live forever.
I don't see you doing any shots of Reaper vodka.
By God, break out the camera. We'll film a video here later. We'll call it Bad Decisions Monday.
God, that decision is going to haunt you for the next few days, probably.
I'm going to make that video eventually, as soon as I have the time. But yeah, and it's kind of weird, though, that, you know, you would think stuff hot would have the opposite effect and, you know, irritate your gut more, but apparently it calms you down.
Well, I mean, so much of what you're getting from heat is just the chemical, you know, like it's not so much, you know.
I mean, it burns going in, it burns going out, but while it's in the middle, it's doing good. You just have to suffer through the side effects or, you know, treat it with marijuana. But I prefer the hot salsa. I mean,
you know, my mouth's on fire. Let me, you know, just take a couple of, you know, hits here. And, all right, there's that numbing sensation. Does that work? Like, I mean, you always hear people, you know, alcohol numbs the, you know, pain receptors and, you know, also increases, you know, helps with numbing the endorphins. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why people, you know, if you're eating spicy foods, oftentimes will elect to go with beer or, you know, something like milk. Or I wonder if weed has that same, you know, calming effect.
I don't know. We'll have to make a...
I guess we're going to need to go to Colorado.
So we can do some experiments for science. Speaking of science, remember Star Wars and Tatooine and, you know, what Luke Skywalker was doing before he, you know, went off to become a rebel?
Yep. Moisture farming.
Yeah, and apparently that is now a possible thing. Scientists at MIT recently published a study in the Journal of Sciences where they're developing ways to basically harvest water from the air to help in, you know, drought-stricken stricken areas. You know, and this is something that's, you know, not new because it's been going on, you know, for a long time. But what's the newest development is they've come up with a technology that they're calling a metal organic framework powered by natural sunlight. It's a technology that can, you know, the whatever metal and organic molecules more easily trap water vapor. And then it's able to release that water vapor using heat captured from the sun. So it really doesn't need any kind of outside electronic source to work. So this could definitely work in, you know, remote impoverished areas. And they're saying this, you know, just 1 kilogram of this stuff can harvest up to 2.8 liters of water a day in relative humidity as low as 20% without any kind of other power source or, you know, fuel for this reaction.
Excuse me, man.
Did I bore you with that?
No, I was just thinking, you know, I mean, you know, think about trips to the desert and that type of thing. And here you are, you know, I mean, that, you know, if you could make that on a portable scale.
Yeah, I mean, it would say, you know, instead of having to carry multiple canteens of water through you on a journey, you just got a brick of this stuff that's, you know, constantly producing water as you go about your day. Yeah, you know, it'd probably definitely cut down on, you know, on storage and whatnot. And
well, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, you know, additional storage, you know, weight, and just, you know, eventually your canteens and stuff are going to run dry. There's not a way to replenish, you know, in a pinch without, you know, having access to, you know, a stream or, you know, a puddle or something to that extent. So here you can just use the, you know, water molecules found in, you know, oxygen.
Or what if they make canteens out of this material and it's a self-filling canteen? That's like the next level shit right there.
Your canteen just turns to water. Fuck. We didn't think this clearly.
And, you know, one last thing, kind of weird science news. You know, of all the woodland creatures you may find, you pretty much think deer are probably the least dangerous. You're not worried about deers chewing on you like some zombified four-legged creatures. You know, hell, up until recently, I thought deer only eat, like, you know, plants and vegetables and whatnot. I've never seen a meat-eating deer. But apparently, scientists have recorded the first instance of deers eating human flesh.
Dun, 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 dun. Zom deer.
I mean, we've had Zombeaver. We're not far off from freaking Zom deer at this point. I mean, that's a horror movie in the makings. But yeah, a recent study published in the Journal of Forensic Scientists, researchers at the Texas Forensics Anthropology Research Facility was doing an experiment where they had left. It's one of these body farm places that you hear about where forensic scientists put bodies out in different environmental conditions to study, you know, what happens to the body when it decomposes to help, you know, forensic scientists better, you know, estimate time of death, you know, environmental factors. There's a lot of, you know, good forensics data that can be learned from, you know, these type of experiments. So they were doing an experiment to see what kind of animals preyed on, you know, human remains and, you know, the type of scavengers they would get and what the scavengers would do to the body and whatnot. And they had set this body up out in the woods and set up, you know, motion activated trail cams to record any, you know, scavengers that came to the area. And they happened to document a couple deer chewing on, you know, human remains. In fact, you know, to fit this to the cigar nerds area, they described one of them as having a rib bone in his mouth that looked like a cigar. So now we know if you fall asleep in the woods, you might get eaten by a deer.
I don't know. I could be more to it.
I mean, in
my head, I think malnutrition of some sort or, you know, something to that extent. You know, I don't know. I mean, dogs will do crazy stuff to get additional nutrients that they may otherwise not be getting. So, I mean.
But what at this point, if, the, you know, like I said, beginning of a horror movie, the deers now have developed a taste for human flesh and, you know, they're going to start, you know, roaming in packs of wild deer that are.
There's going to be a lot of happy rednecks. I hope zombie deer meat tastes as good as just traditional.
He's coming right for us. And with that, we'll be right back.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Check out Rec Level 3.
What's that?
We're a gaming, geek, nerd culture fandom podcast.
Ooh. Wow.
And you can find us every Friday at 11:30 a.m. on reclevel3.com.
Yay.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News. So, this lineup's going to consist of some video game stuff as well as some movie trailers and, you know, talk a little bit about the success, spoiler free, of a little film called Guardians of the Galaxy 2 versus. Hey, Alien Covenant also came out this weekend.
Huh?
Yeah. Nobody's...
I am Groot.
What?
I said, I am Groot.
What?
I am Groot.
Nobody understands you.
The bad part is I've watched that... Like, at this point, I can almost understand Groot.
Well, after your 5 extended, you know...
It could be all the Strike Force talking, but I think I can understand Groot at this point.
Absolutely. So, with no further ado, so Call of Duty looks like it's returning to its original route, so we're going to get a next-gen World War II fighter.
Going old school.
Yep, so, you know, I gotta say that, you know, I'm actually anticipating it, because for so long with the jetpacks and the Halo fill and everything else, like, it'd be nice to go back to, you know,
guns I actually recognize. I just want to rock me at BAR and shoot some Nazis. I mean, because that was like the staple. I mean, you had Call of Duty, Medal of Honor. Every, like, you know, military shooter game was World War II based back in the day. And then we've gone Modern Warfare, and now we've gone, like, beyond Modern Warfare to Future Warfare. And kind of feel nostalgic
space
for the...
Marines.
Yeah, kind of feeling nostalgic for the good old shooting some Nazis.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had, you know, Battlefield 1. So, I mean, I'm wondering now. So, everything went modern, futuristic. Now it's like, what the fuck do we do? Well, let's go back World War, you know, 1, 2, and...
I'm surprised it didn't go back farther. Then we got, like, Call of Duty Civil War and Call of Duty Revolution. You're having to freaking load muskets and shit.
Gotta love some ball ammo. I don't know. I don't think you'll ever get a...
Civil War first-person shooter.
Yeah, I don't think
that'll... Everybody line up in a line.
It'll all be timing-based, you know.
Yeah.
Your countdown in 3, 2, 1, fire. Oh, you were delayed, so you got shot
there
first.
There is the reloading mini-game of trying to pack your musket.
Literally, the challenge is to be able to reload in a minute. So, you know, we're going to get Call of Duty, obviously, on PC, PS4, Xbox One. You know, it looks like, you know, what you're going to get originally is going to be, you know, sort of a, you know, main campaign. Zombies is still up for debate. You know, so I'm kind of curious to see, you know, what kind of World War II zombies, you know, we'll get. I did hear that it was supposed to be independent of the campaign itself, but, you know, as everything goes, it's all subject to change. So, you know, I'm kind of curious to get my hands on it, give it a try, see what it has in store. You know, I think it'd be kind of cool to, you know, get back to, you know, kind of running and gunning and that type of thing as far as multiplayer is concerned, more so than...
Rocking a Thompson and a 1911 45.
Absolutely. So, up next is a game we've talked about previously, you know, a long time ago. Started as a Kickstarter. Man, Kickstarter is just freaking awesome. How many things have, you know, been able to get, you know, some traction and get off the ground?
Movies to, you know, video
board
games and
video
whatnot.
Games.
We should do a Kickstarter. We can finally start off our t-shirt company.
But this game is going to be Friday the 13th, which oddly is not getting a Friday the 13th release date. Instead, it's going to be May 26th. Yeah, so I guess 13 plus 13 is 26. You'll get double the evil.
So yeah, from what it looks like, you're going to be able to play as Jason and hunt the camp counselors, or you can be the kids and see how long you can survive against Jason.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm kind of thinking that that's what's going to happen with the multiplayer variant is it'll be, you know, one person as Jason trying to run around and capture the counselors, or it could be the exact vice versa where you're able to upgrade your counselor or something like that, and it's just
yeah,
it kind of whoever
reminds
me, can survive the
I can't
longest.
Remember the name of the game came out a year or so ago where it was like, there was a big one player played as a big monster, and then all the other players were trying to take down the monster. It's basically the same game, except now we got Jason and some badass, from what it shows, fatality moments. You know, if you're Jason, you catch a counselor. It's yeah, as brutal as you imagine it should be.
Yeah. So you know, I don't know. I'm kind of curious as to, you know, what we're going to see as far as the, you know, actual gameplay. I mean, we've seen some of the customization options and, you know, it looks like Tommy Jarvis has made an appearance.
Pretty much, you can play as any iteration of Jason through all the movies. You can even get that weird baghead Jason from, like, what is it, like number 2 or 3, where he just had like the potato sack over his head with the eye hole cut out.
Yeah, so I don't know. You know, I hopefully it's going to be priced right and it does good. But you know, it'll be one of those games that I'll see how the initial reaction is, and then from there, I may wait for it to show up in a $5 bin. never know.
Just the nostalgia factor of it. I'll have to play it. Yeah.
The nostalgia factor of what versus the old NES, where it's just Jason swimming monstrously fast through Crystal Lake and there's no way to survive.
I mean, I just got like, you know, like I said, I've seen every one of those movies. In fact, I've like marathoned them all in one day and watched every six. So like, yeah, a little bit of more Jason, I'm down for it.
I mean, Mortal Kombat at least gave us, you know, the ability to play Freddy versus Jason, so...
Maybe that'll be the next DLC for it when it comes out. You'll get the Freddy download and you get to play Freddy versus Jason.
You are not mother. All right, well, let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about some movie news. So, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, doing well. Who didn't see that coming? It's probably one of the most highly anticipated movies of the year. I mean,
yeah, and it does not disappoint. I saw it last night. It's fucking amazing.
So, anyway, James Gunn has dropped a little bit of a clue of when we may possibly get Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. So, you know, it's still a ways out. You know, we've seen the Marvel, you know, calendar through 2019, but James Gunn in a recent interview kind of let it slip that maybe 2020 is the year that we can anticipate getting our Volume 3.
Yeah, because we know we're going to see him in Infinity Wars, so we're, you know, they'll be playing in the regular Marvel universe eventually, but then, yeah, you have to go back and, yeah, because everything has to be a trilogy these days.
Yeah, that's kind of the new mantra, I guess.
Yeah, so after we kick Thanos' ass there, you know, the Guardians has to go back and probably find some other big bad out there to kick off, you know, the next, you know, phase 4 or whatever of the MCU.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, we'll keep folks updated as, you know, time nears. But, I mean, I don't think there's going to be any less excitement for a Volume 3 than what there was for Volume 2. So,
I just can't wait to see Peter Quill meet Tony Stark. Those, you know, two egos, or freaking Rocket and Tony. Oh my God, that's going to be hysterical.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, so far the film is really on pace. I mean, I think as of Sunday, I looked at some of the numbers, and it was over $149 million that the film had already grossed.
I think it's up to $156 now, last I saw.
I mean, it debuted Friday with a $56.3 million, you know, one-day opener. So, you know, whatever. I mean...
Yeah,
I mean, Alien Covenant came out, and I gotta say, like, I was sort of, you know, hey, that'd be kind of cool, but, you know, for that movie to come out on the same weekend as, you know, Guardians, like, bad timing.
Yeah, because, I mean, I wasn't that big of a fan of Prometheus, so, I'm like, I'll probably wait to video for Covenant.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things, you know? I mean, Aliens has always kind of got that nostalgia factor. In fact, I'm still holding on to Alien Isolation. At some point, I'm going to get around to playing that game, because it's supposed to be scary as poop.
Oh, that reminds me, random nerd news I saw come across my feed, so I have no research on it. But there's a new card game come out that's kind of like Cards Against Humanity called, like, Make That Something Meme. It was like... But they play a meme with no captions, and you try to find the best caption to go with the meme photo.
That's kind of interesting. Well, you know, hopefully it's not, you know, Pepe the Frog, because he's officially been killed off now.
Oh, I'm sad.
You remember Pepe?
No.
Okay. Yeah, Pepe was a little frog. Apparently he got adopted by some white supremacist. You know, they were kind of using that as... one of their mottos or mantras or something, and, you know, they're crap. So, yeah, the creator has officially killed off Pepe, and he is no more.
Damn.
So, there you go. There's your random tidbit of nerd news that wasn't in the show notes. Next is, we're going to switch it over to Netflix and talk about the Defenders series, and... Who's excited for the Defenders?
Hey,
I mean, we're going to get Murdoch, we're going to get Jessica Jones, we're going to get Iron Fist and Luke Cage all working together as a team.
Yeah,
at
finally.
At some point.
Finally. This should have happened like 3 series ago. I mean, I'm glad Daredevil's back. I've missed him. But yeah, in the trailer, there's like, you know, freaking, Rosario Dawson, like, there's someone you should meet. Bitch, you should have said that like 3 episodes ago. Like,
there's a lot of someones.
Especially during freaking Iron Fist. You're fighting the Hand. You know Daredevil. Personally. You've had sex with Daredevil. He fights the Hand. You probably should have called him. You're like, hey, I got this guy with a glowing fist. We're going to go fight the Hand. You want to join up? No. And she's like, I'll go with you and help you. Call somebody who, like, you know, can actually kick some ass. That was, like I said, it's the team up has gone far too long.
Don't worry, soon enough we'll have the Punisher and you know, Deadpool will be making an appearance. The entire cinematic universe of Marvel is going to, you know, show up in Hell's Kitchen.
I just want to see S.H.I.E.L.D. show up and be like, what the fuck are y'all doing down here?
Fucking amateurs.
Exactly. Coulson has to straighten him out and like, why aren't y'all on the registry?
That would be awesome. In fact, I was kind of thinking about that. I'm like, at some point, you know, if it wasn't just shenanigans taking place in Hell's Kitchen, I think, you know, things would be, you know, more on
they're
Shields.
Not big enough for anyone to care. Yeah. They're like, it's New York.
Yeah. It's just,
we're dealing with aliens and LMDs. We don't give a shit about what happens in the hood. But I do like in the trailer, because the you know, of course, we get to see Styx is back. He was probably one of my favorite side characters from Daredevil. Sigourney Weaver is going to be apparently our bad guy for this series. So that should be pretty badass. They're bringing in some, you know, big names for this go-around. And the line Daredevil has, because he's the only one of these Netflix Avengers that has a secret identity. So they're going into some... building in street clothes, and he's got a scarf wrapped around his face, and Jessica Jones is like, you look like an idiot, and he's like, well, it's your scarf. It's my favorite line of the whole trailer.
I mean, technically, if you're blind, do you really know if it's a bad scarf or not? I mean, how do you hold that against a guy? I mean,
it'd been funny if it was like pink and polka dots and shit. My Little Pony scarf or something.
That'd been awesome. Secretly, Daredevil is a brony.
Secret hell, he's on Front Street with that. He's got his little unicorn.
And next is, we got our trailer for Blade Runner 2049. And it's been a long time since I've seen the original Blade Runner. So, you know, with this, I'm, you know, it's another one that I was like, all right, that's pretty freaking cool. So.
Yeah, it's like, it's been a, yeah. You know, and I got to say, it beats a reboot. Give me more sequels, even like late sequels. Quit rebooting shit. Come up with some new ideas. So, yeah, I mean, it's a teaser trailer, so you ain't got much, but you got some visuals of the world. You get to see, you know, Decker back in the fray. I mean, and the new guy, Ryan Gosling. You know, so it's going to might be like an old, you know, turn into an old futuristic buddy cop film where the rookie's got to go pull the old guy out of retirement to help him on a mission. Yeah, I'm just waiting for Decker to say I'm getting too old for this shit, Riggs.
And then another movie that I'm excited for is Kingsman 2. And,
hell yes.
You know, the glorious bourbon and gunplay.
Because apparently in this version, they meet the American version of the Kingsman called the Statesman, and they're all cowboys.
But man, they distill some whiskey.
Yeah, they're based out of Kentucky. Yeah, I mean, the original movie just, I mean, it came out of nowhere. It's one of those that, like, you know, I mean, it is based on a graphic novel, comic book, whatever, but, you know, it was something I hadn't heard of, but it turned out to be, like, just a badass movie, and it looks like this one's going to be just as action-packed as the original, so I can't wait for this one.
Yeah, I kind of like this, you know, too, because, I mean, there's almost some, like, you know, a little bit of a steampunk element, you know, there to it as well.
It's so. Like, you know, almost like old school James Bond, just the gadgets and whatnot. And, of course, you know, the whatever, the hero from the first movie, or the, what's his name? The Kingsman who trained him and all that stuff, who we thought got killed in the first movie, apparently he's not dead. So, you know, we get, you know, him back into the action. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Kingsman 2, Into the Fray. I mean, the Golden Circle. And then, you know, just to kind of wrap us up here for news is, so, Game of Thrones, we can agree, it was watchable, it was enjoyable, and it's been widely successful. You know, probably one of the most successful HBO series in a long time. Anyway, apparently now there are going to be multiple HBO Game of Thrones spinoffs. And
I just want to see the, Peter Dinklage get his own series and call it I Drink and Know Things.
Yes. So, yeah, I, you know, with the new season coming up, there's a lot of anticipation built up, but man, I feel like if you go off into a whole bunch of different directions that, you know, you're going to take fans away, I feel like.
Especially at this point, we've gotten to the point where we're past what has been written, so we're in, you know, unwritten territories with all this, so it's, yeah. I mean, well, if they can keep it true to the, you know, aesthetic and theme and of what they've done so far.
Yeah, I mean, because we knew we were getting the final two seasons, you know, which was 13 episodes split into two seasons. You know, but, you know,
get a whole White Walker series. Yeah, get their backstory.
I mean, after that, it's. I don't know. I kind of feel like it's going to be the way that Walking Dead is. Like, I just cannot get back into the show now. Like, the dynamics have changed so much that, like, it's...
Yeah, I've still not made it through this last season.
Yeah, I mean, it's just,
I'll watch an episode here and there, but yeah, I can't power through it like I've done some of my other shows that have built up on the DVR.
So, I don't know. With that, we'll keep folks apprised, and any additional news or thoughts, insight?
I just wanted to give a shout out to a past guest, friend of the show, Mike Dixon. He's currently going through some medical issues, so we want to wish him well and tell him we're all thinking about him. And with that, check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com. We're also on the ESO Network at ESOPodcast.com. We are on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at CigarNerdPod. Go check out Real Men Smoke Cigars. Pick you up your Cigar Nerd smoking shirts. Go to StrikeForceEnergy.com. Pick you up some Strikeforce. Use your promo code CigarNerds for 20% off. And keep your football on the pedal and make sure there's no smokies creeping in your back door. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.